CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
Today on Face the Nation, Senate Republicans cut last-minute deals to get their tax bill passed. It's a giant step towards granting the president's wish for a tax bill by Christmas. But a plea deal for former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn might make for a not-so-happy new year for the Trump administration.
The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as amended, is passed.
It was a 3 a.m. call the president said he was happy to get.
I said, call me. You can call me. It's the largest tax decrease in the history of our country by far. Not even close.
As for the news that Flynn is cooperating in the Russia investigation, is the president worried?
No, I'm not. And what has been shown is no collusion. No collusion.
We'll talk about the two big stories in Washington this week and more with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Two senators investigating Russian influence in the election, South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham, and Maine independent Angus King will also be here. Budget Director Mick Mulvaney will set the stage for the next round of tax bill negotiations and handicap the chances of the government shutting down at the end of the week when it runs out of funding. Plus, new poll numbers on the Alabama Senate race. How is Roy Moore faring after allegations of sexual misconduct with minors? All that, plus plenty of political analysis, coming up on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. We knew it would be a busy week when Congress and the White House returned to Washington Monday, but we had no idea just how busy. More stories of sexual misconduct on the part of the longest-serving House Democrat John Conyers and now others prompted more calls for Congress to do a better job of policing its own. North Korea fired another missile, one that, in theory, could reach Washington.
It is a situation that we will handle.
President, tonight, progress on the tax bill continued at a brisk pace after Senate Republicans cut a number of deals to gain its passage, which thrilled the president.
People are going to be very, very happy. They're going to get tremendous, tremendous tax cuts and tax relief.
That remains to be seen. Unsurprisingly, Democrats were not happy. Montana's John Tester tweeted a show and tell of the massive bill.
This is your government at work. Here's the bill as it's written. Here's the modifications that are in it. I can read one word. It's called add this language. Can you tell me what that word is?
Friday arrived with a big development in special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into possible Trump campaign collusion with the Russians and obstruction of justice, as Michael Flynn pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI and said he's cooperating with Mueller. The president further muddied an already complicated story with a Saturday tweet that seemed to suggest he was aware of Flynn lying to the FBI at the time when he was calling the investigation a witch hunt. I had to fire General Flynn because he lied to the vice president and the FBI. He has pled guilty to those lies. The day after the president fired Flynn for lying, former FBI Director James Comey says the president asked him to go easy on his investigation of Flynn. Sources tell CBS News that the tweet was drafted by one of Mr. Trump's attorneys. We want to take a closer look at what the Senate passed. Their bill would repeal the Obamacare individual mandate. The corporate tax rate would be cut from 35% to 20%. It will nearly double the standard tax deduction, eliminate state and local tax deductions, but would allow an up to $10,000 exception for property taxes. The bill would also double the estate tax exemption limit and raise the alternative minimum tax threshold. An analysis of the bill by the nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation indicated that even accounting for economic growth, the tax plan would add $1 trillion to the deficit. We begin this morning with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He joins us from Louisville. Welcome, Mr. Majority Leader. I want to start with the balance of this tax cut that passed through the Senate. The corporate tax rate is at 20%. It's been sold as a middle-class tax cut, but those middle-class taxes will expire. Analysis shows that while the majority of the middle class will get a tax cut, there are some whose taxes will increase. Why not, in putting this bill together, make it so that you could say everybody in the middle class will get a tax cut that's permanent?
Well, it's impossible to do that. You can't craft any bill that would guarantee no one was in a special category that might get a tax increase. What I can tell you is that every segment of taxpayers, every category of taxpayers, on average, gets significant relief. The average family of four, $2,200 a year. You mentioned the standard deduction doubling, the child care credit increase. Clearly, most people, middle-income taxpayers, an overwhelming majority of them, will get tax relief. And because of the business tax changes, it's much less likely that the job they currently have is going to end up in another country, because we are clearly uncompetitive in the global economy with the current tax rates.
But
John, I think this, coupled with the regulatory relief the administration's been providing, are the reasons the economy is beginning to pick up. Consumer confidence is up. I don't want to read too much into quarterly growth rates, but we've had two quarterly growth rates in a row of 3% growth. I think this is going to get the country growing again.
But on the question of the middle class, there would be a way to craft it so that the number of people who might get a tax increase would be pretty small. And there were Republican efforts to expand the earned income tax credit, to make the child tax credit more robust, to lower the rates for people at the lower end. Those were all Republican efforts that didn't get much energy, whereas the energy on the corporate tax rate was always, it's going to be 20%, and nobody's tinkering with that. So just in terms of where the emphasis was on the work, there's much more work that could have been done on the middle class and lower income question than was really done in crafting this bill.
Well, the question is whether you're getting tax relief. And, of course, people on the lower end don't provide a huge percentage of the revenue that we raise through taxation. What people want is, am I going to get some relief myself? Answer, overwhelmingly likely to. And is my job likely to continue to be in the United States? And are we going to have a growing economy so my children will be able to realize the same goals and aspirations that I want them to have?
I think that.
And this is designed, to get the economy grow. We didn't have a single year of 3% growth during all of the Obama years. We were clearly underperforming. You have to ask the question, why?
Yeah.
Combination of overregulation and a lousy tax code.
I think the question was about really the winners and losers. But let's move on to the question of process, because the Democrats, of course, have made a lot of complaints about process. You said on Friday night, you complain about process when you're losing. And the Senate process might seem like something that's not important to people, but you wrote a book called The Long Game in which you talk a lot about the process. You say, in fact, it's what's at the heart of the Senate and why it's a different institution. So this looks like a situation when you're in the minority, you like the process, but when you're in the majority, you move on.
Not true. We followed the regular order. There were multiple hearings. The Democrats were there. Days of hearings, days of amendments. The Democrats offered amendments in committee ad nauseum. The process on the floor, the reconciliation process, is regular order. That's how they passed Obamacare. We didn't do anything that you could call a foul on process.
They didn't like
the fact that we repealed the unpopular individual mandate from Obamacare, but yet they didn't offer a single amendment to take it out, and they had the opportunity to do it.
Well, they had 25 days of debate on Obamacare, and you said the process at the time was arrogant and that they were pushing an unpopular bill through. This bill is unpopular. Why isn't it the same thing?
Well, we'll see how unpopular it is when people start noticing they're paying less in taxes, the economy's growing, there are more jobs and opportunity. Look, we have a very different it was pretty clear during this debate. We have a very different view of what America ought to look like. Our Democratic friends apparently are quite content with slow growth and little opportunity to improve your condition. We think we need to jumpstart the economy and provide more jobs and opportunity for the American people. Well, one of us is going to be proven wrong here over a period of time.
Let me ask you about Roy Moore. We have a poll out. It says Mr. Moore is up 6 points over his Democratic opponent, Doug Jones. And in that poll, it says that among Mr. Moore's supporters, 56% say they were more likely to vote for him after you said he should quit the race. What do you make of that?
Well, look, the people of Alabama are going to decide a week from Tuesday who they want to send to the Senate. It's really up to them. It's been a pretty robust campaign with a lot of people weighing in. The president and I, of course, supported somebody different earlier in the process. But in the end, the voters of Alabama will make their choice.
And should that be the final word? The White House, when asked about the president's accusers, said the voters heard about the president's accusers. They voted for him anyway. End of subject. So shouldn't that be the case with Roy Moore?
Well, look, I'm concerned about the Senate. And if we have two ethics investigations in the Senate going on right now, Senator Franken and Senator Menendez, and there might well be another one, depending upon people who are in the Senate. And it'll be up to the people of Alabama to make this decision, and we'll swear in whoever's elected and see where we are at that particular point.
In the past, you've supported ethics committee determinations of the case of Senator Vitter that said basically behavior before he got to the Senate was not germane in terms of punishing him as a senator. That would seem to cover Roy Moore, in which case, what's the Senate ethics committee got to look into?
Yeah, I don't remember that. I'm not on the ethics committee. I don't remember exactly how the Vitter case was handled, but the ethics committee makes those decisions about whether behavior prior to the Senate is relevant or not. They'll decide the parameters, if you will, of their jurisdiction. And that decision will be made based upon the facts of a particular case. I can imagine there probably will be a case. Whether the outcome is there, I don't know. But look, the ethics committee is 3-3. Neither side can take advantage of the other. It has to be a pretty credible case to go forward. In other words, at least one member of the other party would have to decide that the case was worth pursuing. Okay. All of that will be considered by the committee if they have a member of the Senate that they think has a case that ought to come before them.
All right. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, thanks so much for being with us. Joining us now, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham. Congratulations, Senator, on Clemson's big win.
The Tigers.
I know.
Number one.
Let me pick up on something we were just talking about with the Majority Leader, which is on Roy Moore. The Majority Leader said voters of Alabama are going to decide. Mm-hmm. That seems like there's a new standard. Basically, if it happened before you got into the Senate, the voters will decide. That means it sounds like he's going to be a senator.
I think the body can regulate itself, you know, at the end of the day. When he comes to the Senate, if he does, I think an ethics investigation would be a smart thing to do. And we'll see what the ethics committee decides as to whether they look at behavior before he came into the Senate. Does that matter? If they do, what do they find? We'll see.
Could you have him be a senator by your lights? I mean, would you be able to, based on what you've heard, you'd be okay with him being a senator?
We can't stop him from being seated. If there was an investigation and all six members of the committee said they believe he was a child molester, that'd be a problem.
Let me move on to the president's tweet this morning about the FBI. You're on the Judiciary Committee.
Right.
You oversee the FBI. The president says that after in the tweet, he says, after years of Comey with the phony and dishonest Clinton investigations and more, running the FBI, he's talking about Comey there, its reputation is in tatters, worst in history. But fear not, he says, we'll bring it back to greatness. FBI, worst in history, in tatters? Do you agree?
No. I think Comey needs to answer questions as his time as director. I think he made some decisions that were really very, very wrong. I would just say this to the president. There's an ongoing criminal investigation. Comey may be part of it. You tweet and comment regarding ongoing criminal investigations at your own peril. I'd be careful if I were you, Mr. President. I'd watch this.
You were a former prosecutor.
Right.
Along those lines, the president has said he knew that Flynn lied to the FBI, and yet he has called the investigation into whether Flynn lied to the FBI a witch hunt, and because it was a witch hunt, he fired James Comey. How can you know that you've lied to the FBI and then fire the FBI director for investigating that?
I think, number one, what Flynn lied about is not a crime. I don't think it's wrong for a transition person to talk to a foreign government about changing policy. I don't think the Logan Act is worth the papers written on. So I'm not really worried about what happened after the election in terms of trying to communicate with the Russians about the Israeli resolution or about sanctions. It comes down to the following to me. Was there any effort by the Trump campaign to coordinate with Russian intelligence services or any entity controlled by the Russians to receive benefit during the election? And they found the one guy that would know that.
Let me ask you, though, on that question of obstruction, because that's the other thing that's a part of this issue. And if you know he lied to the FBI, how can you say an investigation into whether he lied to the FBI is a witch hunt that Comey should be fired for carrying out?
Apparently, this statement is that by the president's lawyer.
Yeah.
He says, I didn't know. I mean, he wasn't in on the interview. He did know that he lied to the vice president. The vice president was very upset. He took action. To me, that's not the issue. Here's the issue, from my point of view. If there was coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians, I can't think of a person who would know more about that than Flynn.
Let me ask you, on the national security front, though, you're very critical of the Russians for interfering in the election.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, and a former Obama administration official says the interference was the cyber equivalent or espionage equivalent of 9/11. So if after that kind of an event, give me your foreign policy judgment about an incoming administration that then says to the perpetrators of an event that's that serious, hey, let's work out a deal on these sanctions that are going to punish you for that behavior. Don't overreact because we'll be on your side later when we're in the administration. Yeah, give me your national security judgment.
Okay, well, number one, the Obama administration sure didn't act like it was a 9/11. They were late to the game and did this the least amount possible. What they did in the interim before Trump took office was a slap on the wrist, so I don't buy that whole narrative. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with the Trump administration reaching out to the Russians. We're going to take a different view about sanctions, and we're going to seek your help in the U.N. Security Council.
Even given your rough opinion of the Russians and what they did, it's okay to play footsie with.
Yeah, well, here's what I'm saying. That behavior after the election is reaching out to foreign government that we have a different view about things. I'm not here to condemn the president about that. Here's what I'm saying. That collusion between a campaign and a foreign government is unacceptable. There is no evidence of collusion. Nobody's been charged with it. But you found the one person who would know if it did exist. So it won't be long before we understand one way or the other whether the Trump people colluded with Russia, because I can't imagine it happening and Flynn not know about it.
Senator, before we get to North Korea, one more question on this investigation. The New York Times reported this week the president had made some calls up to the Hill about these investigations into Russian interference. Was that appropriate for him to make those phone calls?
I don't know what the content was, but he's never asked me to stop an investigation. Yeah, it would be inappropriate for the president to say, stop the investigation. It's not inappropriate to have a discussion in general. Again, I just want people to understand. Mike Flynn would know if there was collusion, in my view, between the Trump campaign and the Russians. There's no evidence of collusion yet. Nobody's been charged with collusion. The Manafort lawyer said there was no collusion. But if there was, Flynn would know, and we're going to know pretty soon one way or the other.
But on the larger question, you're not saying it's only about collusion, because there is this obstruction of justice question, which is quite important, lying to the FBI.
A completely different, but that's not my focus right now.
Sure, I understand. Yeah. But I'm saying in general,
absolutely.
You don't want to overlook that.
North Korea.
Where are we with North Korea right now?
We're getting close to a military conflict because North Korea is marching toward marrying up the technology of an ICBM with a nuclear weapon on top that can not only get to America but deliver the weapon. We're running out of time. McMaster said that yesterday. I'm going to urge the Pentagon not to send any more dependence to South Korea. South Korea should be an unaccompanied tour. It's crazy to send spouses and children to South Korea, given the provocation of North Korea. So I want them to stop sending dependents, and I think it's now time to start moving American dependents out of South Korea.
How close? You say we're getting close to military confrontation. What are we talking about here?
The intelligence community can tell you that better than I can, but I had an extensive discussion with the administration about this topic. The policy of the Trump administration is to deny North Korea the capability to hit America with a nuclear-tipped missile, not to contain it. Denial means preemptive war as a last resort. That preemption is becoming more likely as their technology matures. Every missile test, every underground test of a nuclear weapon means the marriage is more likely. I think we're really running out of time. The Chinese are trying, but ineffectively. If there's an underground nuclear test, then you need to get ready for a very serious response by the United States.
Should the Congress be having a big open conversation about preemptive war?
Yeah, I think so. I think the president, as inherent authority as commander-in-chief, has the ability to strike North Korea to protect the American homeland. But this discussion needs to happen among ourselves.
Let me ask you about the president's team. There were a lot of back and forth this week about whether Secretary of State Tillerson was going to stay yeah. in the job. Do you, net-net, after all the reports and so forth is over, do you have confidence in the president's team around him to manage this tricky question?
He's got the best national security team of anybody I've seen since I've been in Washington. The president himself early on made the right decision. I'm not going to allow North Korea to hit America with a nuclear weapon. We're not going to live under that threat. If I have to go to war and I don't want to stop it, I will. Everybody before President Trump screwed it up, including Republicans. Now we need to get it right, and I think he's got the right approach. He's got the right team. I hope China will help us. We're running out of time.
All right, and we have run out of time, Senator. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be back in a moment.
Holiday business gifting season is fast approaching. This year, choose gifts that are simple to give and a joy to get. Choose Omaha Steaks. There's a huge variety, from premium steaks to skillet meals. There's free shipping on most packages, and all gifts are 100% guaranteed. Be confident in your gift choice. You can never start too early. Contact Omaha Steaks today. Enjoy special holiday pricing on the perfect business gift. It's an ideal holiday gift for your clients, employees, or partners. The perfect business gift includes 4 bacon-wrapped tri-tip steaks, 4 Omaha Steak Burgers, 4 gourmet Franks, 2 boneless pork chops, 4 kielbasa sausages, 4 free caramel apple tartlets, plus you'll get free shipping. This exclusive holiday gift package is only $59.99. Go to omahasteaks.com, type nation in the search bar, and choose the perfect business gift. Again, visit omahasteaks.com and enter code nation in the search bar to send or experience this exclusive gift package for only $59.99. And it ships free.
Joining us now is independent Maine Senator Angus King. Welcome, Senator. Mitch McConnell, Majority Leader, says regular order was followed on this tax bill. What's your response?
If that was regular order, I'd hate to see something else. This is the bill I brought it. This is the bill that we got at about 6 o'clock at night that we were going to vote on that night. There were no hearings. There were some general hearings about tax reform. There were zero hearings on the bill. And even the bill that was reported out by the Finance Committee, it was different than what we were handed that we had to vote on a few hours later. And what worries me about this, I commandeered a staffer's desk right off the floor Friday night and read it all the way through. Now, I can't say I understood all of it, but you could do the things that we were talking about, reducing corporate tax rates, doubling the standard deduction, in maybe 50 pages. This is 477 pages, John. There's a lot of stuff in here that I don't think anybody knows what it's all about. I just happened to pick up, I marked in the margin on page 409, domestic oil and gas extraction income. What's that all about? There's a later provision about income on oil and gas from foreign countries. What's that all about? The point is, nobody knew what was going on here. And there was a moment when we could have fixed it. Chuck Schumer moved to recess Friday night about 9 o'clock to Monday. Give people a chance to go through this and dig through it. Party line vote denied. We ended up voting at 3 a.m.
Senator McConnell said Friday night, he said, you know, when you're complaining about the process, it means you're losing.
Well, I think there is, I mean, there's a point there because I heard him complain about the process a lot when I first arrived. But at some point, process matters. I mean, the 86 tax bill, 33 hearings, 10 months. The vote in the Senate, by the way, was 90 to 10. This one barely was dragged across the finish line on a party line vote.
So what happens now?
Well, there's a lot of talk about what the conference will be. I give it 50-50. There'll be no conference. I think there's a chance, because I don't think that either side wants to take either the House or the Senate wants to bring this back to the floor. The House just may take the Senate bill and send it to the president. So what happens now is we've now made a 30-year decision. This may be the most important vote any of us take in our career, because this isn't the reauthorization of the FAA or even the Farm Bill. This is something that's going to affect every American, every business, the whole economy for decades. And what happens now is we're going to see, well, I'll give you three predictions. I got three predictions.
All right, one, you got 30 seconds.
One is you're going to see people put on their long, serious face, as Orrin Hatch did this morning, and say, the deficit's really a problem. We can't do SNAP or Social Security or Medicare. We got to restructure. That's number one. That's the first prediction. Two, we're going to find some really stinky stuff in here that we didn't know. And three, anything good that happens in America in the next year, including good weather at the Super Bowl, is going to be attributed to this bill. Those are my predictions.
I want to ask you about the Intelligence Committee. But first, on the question of spending, government spending at the end of the year, Democratic leaders didn't meet with the president this week. What's your sense of what happens when the government is running out of money?
Well, they're already talking about another short-term, what they call a CR, continuing resolution, that would get us into January and escape this deadline of this week. I think it's really unfortunate. Generally, all the work of the appropriations committees have been done for a budget. We could pass a budget. We could have passed a budget 2 months ago. And I don't sense that nobody wants to shut down. I don't sense that that's going to come unless it's through mutual misunderstanding between the two sides.
Let me ask you about Michael Flynn. Given what you know as a member of the Intelligence Committee, how do you read this plea deal that he made?
Well, I think you can read it in one of two ways. One, you could say he pled to a fairly minor offense and that's the end of it and it's not a big deal. The other, you could say he pled to a fairly minor offense and that means he has a lot to deliver to the prosecutors. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most significant developments, though, has been in the last 24 hours, where the president tweeted yesterday that he fired him because he had lied to the FBI. That's the first time the president has said that. And it was the next day after he was fired that the president allegedly said to Jim Comey, go easy on Flynn. If he said to Comey, go easy on Flynn, knowing that he had lied to the FBI, that ups the ante on that particular part of this whole situation. And I think that may be one of the things Mr. Mueller's focusing upon.
Does that change the shape of your investigation on the Intelligence Committee? Are you looking into obstruction of justice in the work you're doing?
No. And I think that's an important distinction to make. Mueller is a criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. He's a prosecutor. He's looking for criminal violations. We're looking for the facts. And our focus is on what did the Russians do? Will they do it again? What did they do in the States? And was there collusion between the Trump campaign? My concern about all this, John, is that the latter issue, the hot political issue of Trump and the Russians in the campaign, is obscuring the larger issue, which is the Russians attacked our democracy and they're going to do it again. And that's where the focus of our investigation is, and on the collusion issue.
Let me quickly get your thoughts. You're on the Senate Armed Services Committee. You just heard Lindsey Graham talk about Americans preparing for preemptive action in North Korea. What's your take on that?
Well, part of diplomacy has to be the threat of military force in the background. It makes your negotiations credible. But we've really got to lean on the Chinese. They have to be the solution to this. This is not a case. One of the worst terms ever to enter our lexicon is surgical strike. There's no such thing as a surgical strike. And the idea that we can go in and take out their nuclear capability just isn't so. Most of it's deep underground. So we would be talking about a major war on the Korean Peninsula. Plus, Seoul is only 35 miles from the North Korean border. Anything happens in North Korea, Seoul is history. That's 26 million people, including a couple of hundred thousand Americans. So that's, I wouldn't say it's unthinkable. It's got to be credible. But we can't go there anytime soon.
All right, Senator, thank you so much for being with us. And we'll be right back with White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney.
What makes a holiday card unforgettable? Personality. And no one makes it easier or more affordable to create a holiday card full of personality than Vistaprint. Right now, get 50% off all custom holiday cards. That means 30 cards start at less than $15. With hundreds of stunning designs, your personality will shine through with every card you send. Just go to Vistaprint.com today and enter the promo code HOLIDAY to get 50% off all custom holiday cards. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code HOLIDAY.
And we're back with White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. Mr. Director, this is not in your bailiwick, but I've got to ask you as an administration official. Yesterday, the president said that he knew Michael Flynn lied to the FBI, and that's why he fired him. But then consistently, he said this investigation is a witch hunt. But if you lie to the FBI, that's not a witch hunt.
Yeah. John, you're probably asking the exact wrong person about that. It's been kind of a busy week for me. I'm working two jobs. In fact, I'm leaving here to go back over to the CFPB on a Sunday. So I'm probably not the right person to ask about the Flynn investigation.
All right. We'll let that be there. Let me ask you about taxes. The president said that he might be okay with a 22% corporate rate instead of a 20% corporate rate. Is that right? And why the change?
I don't think it's a change. I think what you heard the president say is, look, we're very close to the finish line. You know, he's wanted a 15% rate from the very beginning. That moved to a 20% rate as part of the discussion. My understanding is that the Senate has a 20% rate now. The House has a 20% rate now. We're happy with both of those numbers. If something small happens in conference that gets us across the finish line, we'll look at it on a case-by-case basis. But I don't think you're seeing any significant change in our position on the corporate taxes.
One of the goals for this tax cut plan was that it was going to make taxes less complicated. Taxes are not going to be less complicated if this passes.
They will be for ordinary people. For ordinary Americans, they will be. For small businesses, they're still going to be fairly complex, but they always were. You know, when you sign up to be a pass-through entity, that your life is going to be fairly complicated for taxes. But for ordinary folks, it will be.
But for conservatives who wanted to shrink the IRS is going to have to get bigger to watch all of these new tax regulations, because if you don't, you're not going to squeeze the revenue out that you need to keep the budget more in balance than it would be.
Keep in mind, there's not a lot of new regulations. Yeah, you're going to change the way we treat, again, pass-through entities, but a lot of the deductions are gone. A lot of the loopholes, again, one person's loopholes, another person's deduction, those are gone. So there is still some simplification. So I don't think, you know, you're not going to see a dramatic increase in the size of the IRS in order to administer this law.
Let me ask you about carried interest. You and I have talked about this. The president said the loophole that exists allows people to get away with murder, hedge fund managers and so forth. There have been tweaks in that, but not material changes. Why was that something that couldn't get through, given what the president said, which is that these people who benefit from that loophole are getting away with murder?
Yeah, go back to the very beginning. And you and I have talked about this before. We laid out some principles at the White House. The principle was ordinary families would pay less and it would be simpler for them to pay and the corporate rate would come down. Within those guardrails, we sort of left it up to the House and the Senate. And the House and the Senate, apparently, I think, have both settled on the same plan, which is that if you hold an asset longer than 3 years, you're going to get that carried interest treatment, the same in both bills. And I think that does discourage some of the abuse, the short-term churning and so forth.
But there's not much short-term churning in the carried interest. People who benefit from the carried interest, I think the average holding of the assets is well over 3 years. So it's not something that's going to get at what the president made a big deal about, both as candidate and as president. The treatment that benefits those people he said was getting away with murder is going to continue.
But again, go back to what our priorities were. Ordinary families, lower corporate tax rate, we got that.
Yeah.
What the House and the Senate sort of filled in the details, and that was up to them.
We've talked about this before, but that priority, sticking with the priorities, but the middle class families are still, there's going to be about a quarter that might see their taxes go up. And in the Senate bill, those tax cuts expire. And just in watching this go through, there's been such focus on keeping that corporate rate steady at 20%. But there's been that flexibility on really being able to say what you started being able to say at the beginning of this, which is that everybody in the middle class will get a tax.
Yeah, I'm not sure where the quarter number comes from, but let's talk about the expiration.
Who don't take the standard deduction, who itemize, those are the ones who might see their taxes go up.
Right, but keep in mind also we're doubling the size of the standard deduction, so the number of people who will otherwise itemize will go down dramatically. But anyway, come to this issue of this expiration. We'll call it what it is. It's gaming the system. The Senate rules are so bizarre and so arcane that you have to sort of horseshoe a bill into that Senate reconciliation process, which is why they're supposedly these rates are going to expire after 5 years. The Bush tax cuts were the same way, and most of them didn't expire. We've said before, we say again, if it's good policy, it'll be permanent. If it's bad policy, it'll be temporary.
Gaming the system seems like a dangerous place to be when you're passing legislation.
Well, they did it for health care. Anytime you want to get something through the Senate on 50 votes, you have to sort of.
I know, but do you want to repeat
rules?
The mistakes of the other team that you were so unhappy about? Do you want to repeat those mistakes yourself when you're in charge?
What I'd rather do is change the rules so that ordinary legislation can be considered on an ordinary basis and you're not sitting there forcing policy into procedure. You shouldn't let procedure dictate what your policy is, which is exactly what you have to do because of these rules.
Although people would say those procedures help keep the deficit problem going down. But let me ask you about the shutdown, which might be coming. Governments run out of money. Democrats wouldn't meet with the president. What's the status of things?
Oh, you know, it's funny to see it now that the Republicans are in charge. I think there's a group of right-wingers in the House who say they want to shut the government down. There's a group of Democrats who want to shut the government down over DACA, and there's a group of lawmakers from some of the hurricane states who want to shut the government down until they get what they want. This just sheds light on the fact that the appropriations, the spending system is broken when any little group can sort of hold the government hostage. We need to get beyond that. I think that we will. I don't think you'll see a government shutdown.
People used to say that about you. You were in one of those little groups when you wanted to shut the government down for reasons. You've changed your stripes.
No, all the more reason the system should be fixed. We don't spend money properly in Washington, D.C. We jump these massive bills to massive bills. The government shutdown, I think, John, 17 times in 20 years between 80 and 94, something like that. So
but
it used
but
to happen.
Some people would say, well, then go back to the tax bill, where people basically gave up their fiscal conservatism in order to get a tax bill. That this is always what happens.
No,
you
I
want
mean,
to fix the system,
well,
but the instincts are okay, to
but,
basically...
But my reputation is as a fiscal hawk. At least I hope that it is. And that's why I'm so interested in seeing that tax bill pass, because as deficits are a function of two things, the amount of money in and the amount of money out. Spending is one of those. Tax revenues is the other. We have to get the tax revenues up. That means we have to get back to a healthy American economy, grow the economy so that you make more money, I make more money, ordinary Americans make more money, and so does the government. That helps lessen the deficit.
Obviously, there's a big debate among other deficit hawks about whether this bill meets that criteria.
I've had long conversations with Mr. Corker, yes, sir.
Well, more than him. But anyway, a good shutdown. The president once talked about it would maybe be good to have a shutdown. Is that still his view?
Well, that goes back. I remember when he said that in April, and that goes back to the system being broken. Congress doesn't spend money the way it's supposed to. It's supposed to pass, and I know this is getting deep down in the weeds, 12 different appropriations bills. They don't pass any. And we have these massive bills at the end of the year, and either it passes all at one time or it fails all at one time. And that's sort of managing by crisis to crisis, and it's not a good way to run the country.
Our crisis is we're out of time. Mr. Director, thanks so much.
It's always
for being
a pleasure.
For some analysis on this very busy week, we turn to our political panel. Julie Pace is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. Ramesh Panuru is a senior editor at the National Review. We're also joined by Ron Brownstein, the senior editor at The Atlantic, and a CNN senior political analyst. And Ezra Klein is the founder and editor at large of Vox.com. Ramesh, let me start with you. The tax cut, looks like it's going to passage and signed by the president. So big win for the president. What's your take on it?
It's not just a big win for the president. It's his only major legislative win so far. And I think that is the thing that led to its happening, because Republicans were just desperate to get something across the finish line and be able to tell people that they've accomplished something while in office. So I think it is a big accomplishment. It does achieve several longstanding Republican goals, particularly bringing down that corporate tax rate, which is what this entire bill is designed around.
Ron, how does it shake out in terms of the effects of this bill, do you think?
You know, normally passing a tax cut is like playing tennis without a net in terms of the public reaction. People like the idea. This tax cut is facing 2-to-1 opposition in polling. 60% of Americans in Quinnipiac said it would benefit the rich at the expense of the middle class, which is pretty tough language. And there are reasons for that. I mean, it will increase the deficit by at least $1 trillion in the most optimistic estimates after growth. It puts most of its benefits, 62% by some estimates, into the top 1%. And all of the studies have shown it will have relatively limited impact on accelerating growth. But that, I don't think, is the reason why it is at risk. It's at risk because it departs from earlier tax bills in raising taxes on certain targets, right? People who live in big cities, people who live in blue states. It cuts taxes for alternative energy while preserving them for oil and gas. In many ways, it is as much an enemies list as a tax bill. I mean, it is a clear expression of these are the people on our side. This is other people on the other side, and that I think exposes us to much more political risk than you usually see in a tax bill.
As we're picking up on Ron's point, I was struck when Leader McConnell said, well, we'll see how popular it gets once it passes. Chuck Schumer in 2010, after the Affordable Care Act passed, said, when people learn what's actually in the bill, as this goes along, it's going to become more and more popular. So they've really just switched teams.
Well, there are two actually interesting things about that, because two things happened here. One is that recently Obamacare has gotten a lot more popular. Yeah. It's become a majority popular bill for the first time since its passage, since Trump got elected. But the other thing this tax bill does is, on the way to passage, it casually destabilizes the entire individual insurance market in America. Ooh. So the Republicans had skinny repeal at the end of the Obamacare repeal effort. The main provision of skinny repeal was that they're going to repeal the individual mandate and not really replace it with anything. They knew that was a bad idea. And so the idea was it could only pass if Republicans promised they wouldn't make it law. They would change it at conference. But right now, they've passed a tax bill that, on the way to passage, it gets rid of the individual mandate. According to the Congressional Budget Office, 13 million people will lose health insurance. Insurance premiums will go up by 10%. Individual markets will be much more destabilized. And they don't have an answer for this. So in addition to a tax bill that is incredibly regressive, has all the features Ron just mentioned, it's also going to upend American health insurance markets. And they've not really thought hard about this or what to do about it or how to handle it at all. It's something they did to get a little bit of revenue and didn't really think through on the way to passage.
What's your take, Julie, on this?
Well, politically, big win for the president and Republicans if they can get through the conference process, and they have every political incentive to try to move through that process pretty quickly. I think one of the big things that we have to look at over the next year or two as the president heads toward 2020 is what is the impact of this legislation on his voters? He has made sweeping promises to his voters, working class voters, that they are going to get big tax cuts. There's going to be a lot of tape for Democrats to go back to. If you look at a lot of the analysis that's come through, yes, many middle-class Americans will get some kind of tax cut. Some may not, and for some, it may be fairly minimal. So he's putting a lot of his own political capital into a piece of legislation that may not bring the kind of success for his voters that he is promising.
One intriguing marker in this, if you go back and you look, 25 Democratic senators voted for the Reagan tax cuts in 1981. 12 Democratic senators. 81. The original 81. Oh, 86, everybody voted for it, both parties. It was 90 plus votes. 25 Democratic senators in 81. In 2001, 12 Democratic senators voted for the Bush tax cuts. When this started, there was a lot of expectation that because there are 10 Democrats running in 2018 in states, senators in states that President Trump carried, that he would have a lot of leverage to get them to vote for it. This bill is so tilted toward Republican constituencies relatively narrowly at the top that no Democrat felt compelled, even in states that Trump won by double digits, to vote for it. In stark contrast to 01. Anyway, I understand politics has changed since the 80s and even since 01. But this is not something that they were afraid of opposing, both because of the politics and because of the substance.
And because Trump is less popular than most presidents are.
You can respond to that.
But it seems like North Dakota, West Virginia we're talking about here.
But Raj, you wrote this week about an effort by Senator Rubio and Senator Lee to try to build up that the families at the lower end of this. Why was there resistance to what they were trying to do? There's also other things. Paul Ryan has been a fan of increasing the EITC for childless.
Right.
You could have lowered the rates at the bottom. Why were those, which would have been direct, injections into the middle class and lower class, why were those so hard to get through?
Right. So they weren't the priority for Republicans. Senator Mike Lee and Marco Rubio tried to make payroll tax relief possible for families by extending the child credit to them and pay for that by just increasing the corporate rate less than 1%. Republicans were just dead set against it, 32 of them, saying that we had to keep this 20% rate, that that's somehow written in stone. And the Democrats, by and large, decided they did not want to participate in this bill. They could have carried that across the finish line if they had wanted to.
Ezra, let me back on the health care question. Susan Collins, as a trade for her vote, said that that Mitch McConnell promised her that Alexander Murray, the bill being used to kind of try to stabilize the Affordable Care Act, of course, before the individual mandate was being taken away. Give me your sense on that. And McConnell has committed to that, to bringing that up.
Alexander Murray was designed to deal with some problems that are in Obamacare now, and also the Trump administration's continuing sabotage of Obamacare, particularly the expectation they're going to stop paying the cost-sharing reductions. You cannot pass Alexander Murray after blowing a giant new hole in it. Alexander Murray doesn't fix that. It's not built to fix that. It's not powerful enough to fix that. So, I mean, you can even, these are percentages pulled out of nowhere, but can imagine if Alexander Murray stabilizes the individual markets by 15%, the individual markets destabilizes them by 40%, you have a net worse individual market. This was not a trade that ever made any sense. It's a fig leaf. It's a way of saying that you're doing something without having any idea of what you're actually doing.
Can I get back to Julie's point?
Real quick about the
economic impact of the tax bill. I mean, essentially, you have a Republican coalition now that depends largely on the votes of blue-collar, lower-middle-income whites, and who Trump is speaking to very powerfully on a cultural basis. But you have a tax bill that tilts even more toward the top 1% than the Bush tax cut gave about a quarter of its benefits. This is about 3/5. And the question is, can they hold those blue-collar voters? Well, one way they're doing it is by ramping up, even relative to Bush or Reagan, the cultural antagonism and even the kind of overt kind of racial element in the message. The problem they're getting is that that's pushing away more people at the top. And if you had to predict for 2018 what's a bigger risk, blue-collar people thinking they violated their interests or white-collar people thinking they're violating their values, I'm betting on the latter. That's what we saw in Virginia. That's what we're seeing in Alabama. And the blue-collar side is holding so far for the Republicans.
But the tax bill does reduce taxes on average, including for blue-collar people. The question is, are they going to be upset that other people get a bigger tax cut than they do? And my guess
the people who are recoiling from Trump on cultural grounds will also face higher taxes in blue states. And there are still a lot of Republicans in Southern California, New York, New Jersey, Northern Virginia, suburbs of Minneapolis and Chicago who will be at risk in this bill from voters who are readily pulling away from them on the cultural and racial grounds.
All right, let's switch here to
Julie, let's switch to Michael Flynn. What do we make of this? I mean, obviously, it's a big deal. What's your take on it?
It's a huge deal. And the White House is leaning hard on this idea that in the actual court documents that came out at the end of the week, there is no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. That is true based on what is in the court documents. But I think Senator Graham made a good point. If that is Mueller's aim, to see if that collusion existed, he now has the witness that he, a cooperating witness that he needs. Michael Flynn was by Trump's side throughout the campaign. He was flying on Trump's plane with him. He was with him behind the scenes. He was a major player in terms of their formation of policy, such as it was. And I think the other thing that is significant about the court documents is that it undermines the entire White House argument about why Flynn was fired. They said Flynn was fired essentially because he was freelancing in his conversations with the Russian ambassador. He lied to Mike Pence about it, and he did this on his own. Those court documents say that he was actually in direct conversations with Jared Kushner and with Katie McFarland, who was part of a larger group talking about conversations they were going to have with the Russians. We haven't heard a good explanation from the White House about that right now, but it's very clear that Flynn was not the only person during the transition who was aware that they were going to be talking policy right. with Russian officials.
Can I, transition policy.
To make one just big point about this, if you just step back from Flynn, from Manatos, from everything we're hearing, from the meetings that Sessions forgot, all the times Kushner lied on his security clearances, there's a lot being forgotten about, lied about, misrepresented, for it all to be innocent. I mean, there's some, but we don't know the whole story yet. Mueller is running what appears to be a very expansive and very aggressive investigation. But it is getting to be what we are being asked to believe as innocent is getting to be almost ridiculous. You go back to the Don Trump Jr. emails with a Russian lawyer saying, I would love to get some dirt on Hillary Clinton. There's an overall picture coming together here. And for a group that says they have nothing to hide, there sure is a lot they appear to be trying extremely hard at great legal risk right. to hide.
So, you know, we all want to know what this means for the future of the Mueller investigation. So obviously, because this is a plea agreement, that means that Mueller thought that he could charge Flynn with more than that and that he wants Flynn's cooperation. So, of course, we all want to know what the future holds here. But one thing that we can easily skip over is this just shows terrible judgment on the part of somebody who was the national security advisor and therefore also shows terrible judgment on the part of the person who hired him. The administration's sending out these press releases where they say, oh, this was an Obama guy, Flynn. And, of course, Flynn did work in the Obama administration. But the Obama administration warned the Trump people not to hire him. They went ahead anyway. And it really just shows, again, abysmal judgment from a president who always said he was going to surround himself with the best people.
One thing we know about the special counsel is he does not give out hall passes easily. There was a lot he could have charged Michael Flynn with that he did not charge him with. And the assumption has to be there's a reason why they made that call. The other thing we know about the special counsel, there's a lot we know, there's a lot we don't know. They know a lot more than we do. They may know a lot more than the people they're interviewing do. And I think that limits our ability to truly understand where this is going, except every indication is that this is a very serious, aggressive, and comprehensive investigation.
All right, we're going to have to end it there. Thanks to all of you. That's it for us today. Thanks for watching. Be sure to tune into the CBS Evening News tomorrow night as we begin a new era with Jeff Glore. He's taking over as anchor of the broadcast. Until next week, for Face the Nation, I'm John Dickerson. Today's guests were Senate Leader Mitch McConnell, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, Independent Maine Senator Angus King, and Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producers are Jill Jackson and Ed Forgetson. The broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsnick. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern every Sunday.